Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. Broken Code: Inside Facebook and the Fight to Expose Its Harmful Secrets by Jeff Horwitz. In a welcome departure from the subgenre of stories about Facebook, Jeff Horwitz's Broken Code doesn't open in a Harvard dorm room. Expanding on the revelations of his blockbuster Facebook Files series of articles in The Wall Street Journal, the book focuses squarely on the past decade. It begins when Facebook is already a global behemoth with a user count in the billions and a company ethos that has yet to account for its capacity to affect enormous social and political change. Building things is way more fun than making things secure and safe, a former vice president at Facebook tells Horwitz. Until there's a regulatory or press fire, you don't deal with it. As a thesis statement, it couldn't get much clearer. Again and again, defining the protestations of employees hired to make Facebook a safe place for users, Mark Zuckerberg, the chief executive, and his closest lieutenants have chosen to prioritize growth and engagement over any other objective. That's demonstrably true even when the decisions are known to cause harm to users. Horwitz draws on reams of evidence to prove that, as a matter of consistent policy, Facebook would rather clean up after even the gravest of disasters than prevent them. The level of journalistic detail in this book is admirable. Broken Code was built on more than 25,000 pages of internal Facebook documents, a majority of which were shared by a single employee, a product manager named Frances Hogan. Her cooperation with Horwitz's investigation was extraordinary. Before leaving the company in May 2021, Hogan spent months sending the reporter blurry screenshots from a burner phone of files pulled up on her work laptop. The documents she and others provided are essential to the precision with which Broken Code fillets Facebook's strategic failures to address its part in the spread of disinformation, political fracturing, and even genocide. The book is stuffed with eye-popping, sometimes Orwellian statistics and anecdotes that could have come only from the inside. Savor, for instance, the irony that around 2018, the company made more than 140 separate changes to its newsfeed ranking system, successfully rooting out the most blatant publishers of fake news. But Facebook couldn't take public credit for the victory after Zuckerberg had insisted the problem of the hoaxers was inconsequential. Broken Code sometimes feels as Byzantine as the corporate bureaucracy it portrays. Much of the book ricochets from crisis to crisis and character to character, without an explicit narrative arc or even chapter headings to make the material feel less unwieldy. The platform's roles in promoting anorexia, disseminating child sex abuse content, fomenting the January 6th Capitol riot, enabling ethnic cleansing in Myanmar, and facilitating domestic servitude, to name some of the most troubling. Facebook is a huge organization, and often the battles Horwitz describes involve the competing priorities of different teams, whose relationships to one another are hard to keep straight. It's clear that after several years of reporting on Facebook, Horwitz has an impressively kaleidoscopic organization chart in his head. It would have been a service to the reader to jot it down, like the maps of Middle Earth in Tolkien novels. Parts of Broken Code feel rushed, repetitions ranging from the merely annoying to the potentially confounding. Explaining Facebook's attempts to quantify meaningful social interactions, Horwitz writes that comments seemed more meaningful than emoji reactions, and emojis seemed more meaningful than likes. The next sentence seems to forget the previous one. Comments and reshares fit in there somewhere too, but how to weight these actions' relative importance was not yet clear. More worrisome are repetitions that don't match, or that befog details. as when a company initiative to shield VIP users from content moderation is cited as protecting at least 7 million of the platform's most prominent users on one page and 6 million users two pages later. The few inconsistencies are all the more conspicuous in a book that so frequently makes serious, sophisticated observations and arguments. Horwitz elegantly illuminates one reason Facebook's top brass could be slow to recognize the dangerous influence of the platform's network effects on the average user, who was more vulnerable to misinformation than the savvier, more educated executives whose own feeds showed them content created or shared by their savvy, educated friends. Fires that broke out on Facebook's lower floors had to become full-on infernos before its penthouse dwellers ever smelled smoke, Horwitz writes. It's unclear whether Zuckerberg gave interviews specifically for this book. An endnote says only that Facebook authorized background interviews with a range of its executives. But he emerges through others' impressions as a kind of remote, perpetually distracted emperor figure. In one memorable episode, a seasoned machine learning specialist develops a novel algorithmic change that, if put into effect, will dampen the voices of hyperactive users who are more likely to share misinformation. Zuckerberg listens for 10 minutes and orders, "Do it, but cut the waiting by 80%, a directive obviously meant to render the initiative toothless. The narrative starts to feel more focused once Hogan is properly introduced in the book's final third. This section is the strongest, combining Facebook's key role in spreading post-election disinformation and polarization with the inside baseball news media drama of how publishing the Facebook Files articles played out for Horowitz, Hogan, and other sources. And, of course, for Facebook itself, soon to become Meta in a rebrand announced the month after the Facebook Files series ran. In a disheartening but inevitable denouement, the company's scramble to control the reputational damage it suffers from Horwitz's reporting results in a crackdown on leaking and instructions for self-censorship. The entirety of Facebook's staff working on integrity and societal issues was now literally reporting to marketing, Horwitz writes. In the book's final pages, Horwitz examines an internal experiment in which Facebook's own frustrated data scientists showed in 2021 that the deep-seated notion that underpins almost all the conflict in this book, what's good for integrity is bad for engagement, was mistaken all along. Watering down its integrity ranking weakened Facebook usage for only 6 months. After a year, the integrity work began producing a modest but statistically significant usage gain. It's hard to imagine a sharper last-act twist. The finding supercharges the pathos of the entire book. Every damning episode it describes is now both moral tragedy and strategic farce. This review was written by Alexandria Simons, who is an assistant editor in the graphics department at The Times. She has a master's degree in data, economics, and development policy from MIT. What's cooking in the Kremlin? From Rasputin to Putin, how Russia built an empire with a knife and fork, by Witold Zablowski. Witold Zablowski describes a number of surprising dishes in his entertaining yet unnerving new book, What's Cooking in the Kremlin, which explores the last century of Russian history through its food. But none is as surreal as the recipe for one of Lenin's favorites. The instructions for making his scrambled eggs, using 3 eggs, orders you to break the eggs but not to beat them. What Lenin called scrambled eggs were actually fried eggs with their yolks and whites intact, not scrambled at all. Zablowski's previous books include How to Feed a Dictator and Dancing Bears. As a Polish journalist born in 1980, he doesn't have much nostalgia for the Soviet Union, though he has spent considerable time talking to people who do. The chapter about Lenin is mostly narrated by a Moscow tour guide who speaks wistfully of what might have happened if Lenin's dreams had come true. This tour guide turns out to be a composite of three people, a fact that is annoyingly slipped into the bibliography. Zablowski eventually intervenes with his own skeptical interpretation of events, but much of the book, translated into chatty English by Antonia Lloyd-Jones, is given over to oral history for a reason. I began to think of Lenin's scrambled eggs as a metaphor. The stories that people insist on telling show how propaganda works. It doesn't matter if a story is true, Zablowski writes. What matters is that people believe it. Of course, believing in a story becomes exceedingly hard to do when fiction runs up against the stubborn reality of hunger. Zablowski's whimsical title doesn't quite convey how sensitively he writes not just about food, but also its terrible absence. In one chapter, a nonagenarian who survived the 1933 famine in Ukraine recalls how special government commissions went door to door to make sure that no one was storing food. Inspectors confiscated anything potentially edible, including candles, which desperate people had tried to make into soup. Another nonagenarian who lived through the siege of Leningrad resented the hippo at the zoo that continued to get fed every day while she ate aspic that her mother made out of glue. A lack of food tells an irrefutable truth, but food, as Zablowski shows, can also lie. Poison has a long history in Russian politics. Consequently, the chefs who cook for the Kremlin's leaders are vetted by the security service and have a military rank. One of Stalin's chefs refused to get his medicine from the pharmacy for state officials because he feared it might be poisoned. Lenin's widow died in 1939 after eating a suspicious cake. It is highly probable that the cake was sent to her by Stalin, Zablowski writes. And there were other, less lethal ways of using food as an instrument of deception. Zablowski recounts how lavish state receptions in the Brezhnev era masked the reality of empty store shelves and economic stagnation. A Kremlin chef who cooked feasts while the Soviet Union crumbled reminisces about how he and his colleagues were required to learn decorative techniques to transform a cucumber into a fence and a tomato into a rose. Sometimes the leaders themselves did what they could to help out with the show. Nikita Khrushchev, who was less able to handle his liquor as he grew older, had special thick-bottomed glasses made for him that looked like they contained a full shot of booze, but in fact held little more than half. Zablowski talks to cooks working far from the Kremlin who became disillusioned in the line of duty. One went to Afghanistan during a war that Soviet officials kept calling a fraternal intervention, and tried to boost the soldiers' morale by slipping bay leaves into their soup bowls. The ingredients had to be flown in because the commanders feared the Afghans would poison the Soviets' food. The cook secretly used her own money to buy fresh produce from the market for the soldiers, and she never poisoned anyone. She went from believing everything they said on television to realizing that entire fraternal intervention of ours was of no use to anyone at all. For a chapter on the 1986 nuclear disaster at Chernobyl, Zablowski interviewed several women who were sent there to cook for the cleanup crew. They slept on mattresses so radioactive their dosimeters went haywire. Those who survived suffer from severe health problems. One woman has had 11 operations. Another can't carry anything heavier than a bar of soap. The chapter ends with a recipe the cooks gave Zablowski for a Parisian salad. Lettuce, they assert, can be substituted for the watercress, though nota bene, watercress is thought to be better for the health than any other vegetable, a detail as moving as it is absurd. Like the people they cooked for, these women were routinely blasted by deadly radiation, yet they still took care to specify the healthiest vegetable. What's Cooking in the Kremlin was first published in Poland toward the end of 2021, 3 months before Vladimir Putin, whose own grandfather was a chef, ordered his troops to invade Ukraine. In his preface, Zablowski says that researching his book would be impossible now. This edition mentions Yevgeny Prigozhin, the former caterer who, before attempting a coup, built the paramilitary force that helped Putin wage war on Ukraine. Prigozhin died in a plane crash in August. A belligerent mercenary with a culinary career may sound preposterous, but Zablowski's tour through Russian history shows that loyalty in a chef can count for a lot. Readers of this book should no longer be surprised that in Russia, the grandson of one cook clashed with another cook in the fight for power, Zablowski writes. Food can contain danger, and so it entails trust, too. This review was written by Jennifer Zalai. She is the nonfiction book critic for The Times. Network of Lies, the epic saga of Fox News, Donald Trump, and the battle for American democracy, by Brian Stelter. It's easy to be blasé about a new exposé of Fox News. There have been many, going back at least as far as Al Franken's best-selling 2003 book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. Fox News, at this point, resembles a car whose windshield is thickly encrusted with traffic citations. Yet this car, surely a Hummer, manages to barrel out anew each day, plowing over 6 more mailboxes, 5 more crossing guards, 4 elderly scientists, 3 communal enterprises, 2 trans kids, and a solar panel. 2 new Fox books are out. Michael Wolff's The Fall, The End of Fox News and the Murdoch Dynasty, which was published earlier this fall, has already been reviewed in this newspaper. Now comes Brian Stelter's Network of Lies, the epic saga of Fox News, Donald Trump, and the battle for American democracy. The authors and their books make a study in contrasts. Wolff strides onto the page like the devil's ambassador, a man who has cut his own share of bargains, one who has an intimate understanding of what Sun Tzu called the strategic disposition of power. He appears to have the soul of a pirate. His book is laced with innuendo. It reads at times like a brash, wised-up monologue, something Eric Bogosian might deliver. Stelter, a young fogey who once worked at the New York Times, has a wonkier disposition. He uses words like shenanigans. He wrote his book, he says, to help readers feel empowered to push back. He's like a Canadian Mountie who has stumbled upon a gerbil-stomping ring. For Stelter, journalism might be a humble calling, but it is a patriotic and noble one. It burns him to see its ideals perverted. Stelter barely mentions Wolff in his book, except to say, in a line that seems lifted from a colonial-era newspaper, that his pen is oft full of poison. Wolff, being Wolff, puts Stelter in a headlock and gives him a noogie. He calls Stelter, who hosted a media show on CNN for 9 years, that network's designated Fox besmircher. Wolff writes that CNN fired Stelter in 2022, at least in part because his sense of personal outrage seemed to trend into self-parody. I admire a lot of things about Wolff's book. He knows more about the inner workings of the Murdoch family, and he has a silky sense of human motivation. And oddly, his might be the more influential of the two. This is because loyal followers of hosts like Sean Hannity are more likely to read it than one by Stelter, a longtime Fox News punching bag. Yet Stelter's is the better book. He delivers a straightforward, grinding, momentum-building account from an inside Fox News perspective of the conspiracy to steal the 2020 presidential election, the January 6th attack on the Capitol, the Dominion voting system's defamation lawsuit, and Tucker Carlson's defenestration. He does this so deftly that Network of Lies reads like one of Bob Woodward's mightier books. Stelter makes especially good use of the years of private texts, emails, chats, and memos that Fox News was forced to release to Dominion. Stelter's guilelessness matters for reasons Martin Amis understood. Amis told the Paris Review all the way back in 1998, when Fox News was 2 years old, "As the planet gets progressively less innocent, you need a more innocent eye to see it." Much of the Dominion case material has been previously reported, yet Stelter finds new nuggets. The essential thing he does is lash this material together as if he were a prosecutor and turn it into a narrative with sweep and power. He places timestamps on obvious lie after obvious lie from Fox insiders, nearly all of whom knew they were peddling snake oil. Stelter has watched a lot of Fox News, nearly as much as anybody alive. In doing so, he has been, to borrow a term from Succession, the Murdoch family-inspired HBO series, a national pain sponge. He has been glued to the set, eyes peeled, notebook in hand, so others don't have to be. He really lets the brown water flow over you. His Fox News is a nightly Russell Stover assortment of ginned-up grievances and predictions of cataclysm and collapse. The network delivers insinuation instead of reason in this account, irritable gestures instead of journalism, a great deal of voice and little of mind. Fox News is biased against expertise and culture. Its hosts patrol and destroy any hint of sequential reasoning, as white blood cells do in the body. They deliver the kind of shallow and primitive totalitarian propaganda that George Orwell, in 1984, called prolifeed. In Network of Lies, it is a dead-end grotto of the human spirit. Flood the zone with wit, as Steve Bannon did not say. Stelter spends a good deal of time on Tucker Carlson. There is his big, hysterical, hyena-like laugh and his look of chronic dyspepsia. More essentially, there is his mainstreaming of white nationalism. His paranoid messages sounded good to certain ears. You are being manipulated. It's our country, not theirs. Your views are not evil. Stelter describes how, when Carlson left Washington, D.C., and began spending all his time in remote Maine and on an island in Florida, the isolation changed him because it separated him from people and events, from the diversity of the real world. Carlson's influence over the Republican Party was enormous. He was like Joaquin Phoenix in Gladiator, asking the crowd to give a thumbs up on whether someone, in this case a politician, lived or died. Stelter tracks the long list of reasons that led to his firing: ad boycotts, sexist and racist texts, the dislike colleagues felt for him, his smug sense that he was bigger than his network. Carlson and Fox News changed conservatism. Together, they put the wedgie into wedge issues. And they helped erode, Stelter writes, some Republicans' commitment to the basic tenets of democracy. Alongside Trump, Fox changed the tone of American conversation. This is what trickle-down has come to mean. We live in a stupider, more bellicose world. Reading Stelter, I was reminded of a tweet that made the rounds a few years ago. Fox News did to our parents what they thought video games would do to us. Stelter's book never takes its eyes for long off Rupert Murdoch, the family patriarch. He is 92, and, not to be ghoulish about it, the death watch is on. Stelter quotes a conservative media insider who tells him Rupert's death will change politics more than Trump's descent down the escalator. Nearly a century ago, the British journalist C.P. Scott is said to have predicted that no good would come of television because the word is half Greek and half Latin. On television these days, cards are being shuffled in the run-up to the 2024 election. Stelter's excellent book makes one fear that no ace will rise to the top of the deck. This review was written by Dwight Garner. He has been a book critic for The Times since 2008. Baumgartner by Paul Auster. In Auster's new novel, an aging philosophy professor struggles to move on after the accidental death of his wife nearly a decade earlier. The book shuttles between present and past, between a solitary life of writing and a passionate, decades-long relationship that continues to haunt him. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.